Good afternoon. Firstly, I'd like to thank the organizing committee for extending their invitation for me to present our group's recent findings on axials and topological defects. The outline of my talk is as follows. In the first half of the talk, I'll be discussing axions and a variety of oscillating effects which they may induce in atoms, molecules, and nuclei. These include a number of odd parity effects, as well as even parity effects. In the second half of my talk, I'll be discussing topological defects and ways in which we can search for these objects via non-gravitational signatures. So I'll be talking about a number of terrestrial detection schemes, astrophysical detection schemes, as well as what can we learn about possible search ranges for atomic clock experiments, which Andrei Didovanko talked about on Monday, from the so-called pulsar glitch phenomenon. So this is a rough outline of my talk today. So let's start with axions first. It's well known that the QCD Lagrangian contains this anomalous CP violating interaction, which is parameterized by this value theta bar. And the interesting question is, out of all the possible values which this theta term could have taken between 0 and pi, why is it so small when we actually observe this? And Peche and Quinn came up with a very elegant solution to this so-called strong CP problem by turning this theta term into a phase by the introduction of an additional U1 symmetry, which is known as the Peche-Quinn symmetry. And this Peche-Quinn symmetry was then subsequently broken both spontaneously and explicitly to give rise to a massive pseudoscalar particle, which is known as the axion. So in essence, we are replacing this theta term by the axion. So we have A for the axion field, and FA for the axion decay constant. And most of our modern day interest in axions stems from the fact that they may be one of the possible candidates for cold dark matter. So a brief history of how axions, modern day axions, are believed to have arisen. So in the very early universe, we had an axionic boson-Einstein condensate form. And so initially the coherence length of this axionic field was very large, but over time, this boson-Einstein condensate became virialized and attained a virial velocity of the order of 300 kilometers a second, which is typical for the position in the Milky Way galaxy in which we find ourselves. So as a result of this virialization, the coherence length of this axion field shrunk to the order of its de Broglie wavelength. And so what we find is that on distance scales of the order of the de Broglie wavelength, this axion field essentially acts as some coherently oscillating classical field. And the frequency of these oscillations is given by the mass of the axion field. And in general, depending on who you ask, this axion mass can lie in essentially one of two ranges. Of course, there are many possible ranges, but two of the most common ones are the so-called classical region and the anthropic region. And this talk, I'll be focusing on axions in the classical region, which in general are considered to be one of the more likely search ranges. Yes?
Quick question. So Gitz's talk, when he was talking about axions, he never said Bose-Einstein condensate. And you're saying Bose-Einstein condensate. So is there a difference between these regimes for axions?
Which ones?
Bose condensate or not Bose?
It's just semantics.
There sure is just semantics. I think there is a difference, but let's not go into that.
Okay.
Why? Take some time. We can postpone it.
Is it possible to discuss this?
Yes, I'd like to discuss that as well. Right? I mean,
yeah, maybe that's good for open mic.
Yes.
So we have a very good program for open mic. Except that Mark is going to disappear in 5 minutes. So.
Oh.
Okay. But basically, we're going to focus on this classical region. And it was pointed out several years ago by Peter Graham and Tajik Rajendran that this anomalous coupling of the axion field to the gluons, with theta being an oscillatory term, would result in oscillating electric dipole moments of the nucleons, as well as oscillating nucleon shift moments. And this idea was then subsequently developed into an experimental scheme, about which Surajit talked about today, known as CASPER. So in the first half of the talk, I'm going to assume for the purposes of numerical estimates, that axions saturate the entire local cold dark matter content. And so the ratio of axion parameters would be roughly of the order of 10 to negative 18. And so what we can then do is express the neutron electric dipole moment in terms of this theta parameter, take theta to be oscillating with this range of axion, with this combination of axion parameters, which will give us essentially a neutron EDM of the order of 10 to negative 34 electron centimeters, which is roughly 8 orders of magnitude smaller than the present static limit on the neutron EDM. So we can also consider oscillating atomic electric dipole moments, which arise from hadronic mechanisms. And essentially, there are two mechanisms through which this can arise. The first of this is the parity and time reversal violating nuclear-nuclear interaction, which is mediated by pion exchange. And this is the mechanism which dominates in heavy atoms. The second mechanism which we can consider is the intrinsic electric dipole moments of the nucleons which comprise the nucleus. And the dominant contribution to the second of these mechanisms arises from the valence nucleons inside your nucleus, but the core nucleons inside your nucleus can also contribute due to configuration mixing of the nuclear wave function. So in heavy atoms, we have incomplete screening of the electric field, and this is primarily due to the finite nuclear size. And we quantify the complete lack of screening of this of the electric field by the nuclear shift moment. And so if we assume that the axion mass is at the upper end of the classical range of the axion masses, we can calculate the predicted values of the oscillating electric dipole moments, which would be induced, for instance, in mercury and in radium. So mercury is a particularly important system for searches of the static electric dipole moment. And radium is also a particularly interesting system because in radium, we have octopolar deformation of the nucleus, and we have a very large enhancement of the nuclear shift moment compared to, for instance, in mercury. And it's the enhancement is roughly 500-fold.
So this estimate actually depends on the value of the wave?
In this case, so if we go back one slide, A naught and FA, if we assume saturation of local cold dark matter content, is independent of MA. But as I'll come to later, with derivative type couplings, MA plays an important role. So these ones, it doesn't depend on MA.
Is there any way to know of these atomic calculations and nuclear calculations that people use in nuclear static EDM?
Yes, so how was this done, basically?
Well, I mean, is this exactly identical to static EDM, or is it in effect?
It doesn't matter in this case. No.
So there's no other.
Yes.
Can you break the shift theorem in some other?
Shift theorem, in principle, you can break because it's a time dependent electric field. But we didn't calculate this correction. It'll probably be very small because numerical estimates from about 30 years ago showed that the amount of unscreening of the actual nuclear EDM, it roughly scales as frequency of your applied electric field. So this looked at time-dependent electric fields and a static nuclear EDM. But the same situation holds true if you have a static electric field and an oscillating nuclear EDM. And it was roughly a suppression factor of the order of omega on some transition frequency squared. But this was only for low frequencies. So in general, it should be quite small. Okay, I'll continue. So apart from this, the EDMs which can arise from this anomalous coupling of the axion field to the gluons, we can also consider a derivative-type coupling between an axion field and the axial vector current associated with a fermion, be it an electron, a proton, or a neutron. And what we find is, for instance, from the temporal component of this interaction, we find the coupling of a spin of this fermion with its momentum, and this occurs in a symmetry fashion. So we can have paranoid conservation effects, electric dipole moments and anapole moments, about which I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. And we can also have, stemming from the spatial components of this interaction, the coupling of the spin of a fermion to the momentum of an axion. And this sometimes it's called by the more colloquial name of the axial wind effect, which is simply the coupling of your fermion spin with some anomalous magnetic background field, which is oscillating. Another effect which stems from the spatial components of your of this derivative type coupling is a spin gravity coupling, which is mediated by the axion field. And the essence of this is the axion field essentially is modified by this gravitation field, which we can treat to be essentially Coulombic. And when we perform necessary operations in this Lagrangian, we find a spin gravity coupling as well. So let's talk a bit more about these odd parity effects. So consider this interaction between the spin of an electron coupling to its momentum. So this is a p-odd Tevin interaction. And if we were to consider this in the static case, then we would not have any atomic electrodipole moments induced. But because of the time-dependent nature of this interaction, we can in fact find an atomic electrodipole moment induced, albeit it will be suppressed because of an additional required change in phase in your perturbed wave function. So in a non-relativistic limit, these induced atomic electrodipole moments are essentially determined by a dynamic polarizability and with the assumption of a small axion mass, so 10 to negative 4 electron volts, is much smaller than all the relevant energy separations between opposite parity states and cesium. We can use a static polarizability, and we can make predictions for the sizes of these electrodipole moments, which are induced through electronic mechanisms as opposed to hydro.
What actually gave you the coupling to the magnetic field?
Which one? Sigma dot B?
It's still the
spatial.
Right. So it's the same coupling.
Yes, it's the same coupling. So these are both P odd couplings,
right.
But the difference is this gives rise to P odd effects, but this one gives rise to P even effects. In atoms.
No, I'm just confused because initially you had the coupling of axion to
gluon. Which one?
Okay.
All right.
This is the one interaction.
Yes. So we can compare, for instance, the induced electrodipole moments, which are predicted for atoms via hadronic mechanisms and electronic mechanisms, and for the particular axion mass which I'm considering in this talk, they'd be roughly of the same order of magnitude. And one thing to note is that all these estimates are many orders of magnitude smaller than the current best limit of a static electrodipole moment in atoms, which suggests that detection of these effects would be extremely challenging, and in general we need to think of an alternative detection scheme, for instance CASPER. And so the second of these odd parity effects which might be induced by axions are essentially oscillatory parity conservation in atoms. And so here essentially we have the direct interaction of an electron field with an axion field to give us these parity conservation effects. And this is different from the usual conventional PNC effects which are mediated by Z boson transfer between the atomic electrons and your nucleons in the nucleus. There are a number of very peculiar features about these axion-induced PNC effects in that, namely, in the non-relativistic limits, the matrix elements, in fact, between the opposite parity states, scale as the energy difference between your two opposite parity states. And a direct consequence of this is that all non-parity conserving amplitudes, in fact, vanish in the non-relativistic limit, which means that whenever we calculate these amplitudes, they're going to be determined purely from relativistic effects. And the last of these odd parity effects which might be induced by axions are oscillating anapole moments, which are essentially just parity violating electromagnetic moments which are associated with atomic nucleus. And conventionally, this would arise from parity violating forces inside your nucleus. But just like in the case of axion-induced PNC, we can have an anapole moment arising from the direct interaction of your axion and your nucleon. And the interest and importance in anapole moments is that in atoms, they in fact dominate nuclear spin dependent parity conservation effects. And if you consider molecules in which we have a closely spaced pair of opposite parity states, then they in fact dominate essentially dominate the whole PNC effect because the weak charge kind of makes these opposite parity states.
In diatomic molecules,
yes. So apart from just axion fields, we can also consider pseudoscalar cosmic fields, for instance, or axion-like particles via an analogous derivative type coupling. And we can also consider a pseudovector cosmic field interacting by, a similar looking but a distinct coupling. And in principle, both of these types of interactions would also give rise to these oscillating odd parity effects in atoms, molecules, and nuclei. But there's a particularly interesting situation that occurs for a pseudovector field, in that namely, the derivative type coupling effects vanish for a massless or a static cosmic field, a pseudoscalar cosmic field. But for a pseudovector cosmic field, we can have a static case. And this will essentially give rise to an extra source of parity conservation, both nuclear spin independent and nuclear spin dependent in atoms and molecules. And Vladimir will talk later today about how we can extract limits on the strengths of the interaction of this pseudovector cosmic field with an electron, a proton, and with the, soon hopefully new data in ytterbium, limit on interaction with the neutron as well.
So you assume that there's mu point somewhere, or?
Which one? B mu. It's also CPT odd Lorentz invariant violating, yes.
Once you see that, this background is like an ether.
Yes.
Won't you see that in Lorentz violating?
In Mike's experiments, won't you see that?
In this one, you see, so there's a difference. So we're talking about B0. So in general searches for sidereal modulations of the transition frequencies, you're looking for the spatial components,
right,
which give rise to P even effects.
Yes,
but we always move
but,
on top
yeah.
of any Lorentz frame, right? That's,
yes.
That's
so
B0,
that's the minus three suppression. You have to minus
yes, but he has constraints of 10 minus 30.
Which are much bigger.
GV, right? So it's,
that was the question, by the way, in the list of open questions in the beginning.
Okay, okay.
But there is no question here. B vector is 10 to the minus 3 of B naught, whatever you assume B naught to be. Okay.
Provided
so
you know the speed.
10 to the minus 4, right?
Okay, 10 to the minus 4.
Okay, all right.
Then you ask us, this will not such a B vector be seen in Lorentz bound, I think.
You might want to have somehow patches of this being disoriented somehow, right? But you only see.
Okay, so let's save this question for open discussion because it's a very interesting question and we thought about this a lot, but we still need probably more input. Okay, so now let's talk about topological defects and how we can detect them via non-gravitational signatures. So topological defects are essentially just configurations of scalar or vector fields which are extended in space. And these topological defects may have formed in early cosmological times, provided that we had suitable initial conditions, as well as some self-potential, which could support soliton solutions. There are a number of dimensionalities which these defects could take, for instance, zero-dimensional, one-dimensional, two-dimensional. And the challenge with topological defect dark matter detection stems from the fact that with topological defects, in general, we do not know the actual masses, their sizes, the speeds at which they travel. In general, we don't know much. We know some constraints on how many of these defects there might be, for instance, but we don't know the exact physical properties of these defects because we've never actually observed them before. We do know some things, for instance, the transverse size of these defects with scales the reciprocal of the, yes?
Is there any reason you're not discussing the higher dimension defects like textures?
Oh, that's a bit complicated. No, so we just focus on the simple ones, yes. So the interest in topological defects is that they may contribute some fraction of the total dark matter content of the universe. And traditionally, defects have been sought from roughly the 80s onwards via gravitational signatures in astrophysical settings. So we can look, for instance, at gravitational lensing and gravitational waves. But as yet, as I just mentioned, that we in fact haven't observed any defects directly. So it makes sense to consider other possible types of detection schemes for defects via not necessarily gravitational effects. And for instance, we can use a global network of magnetometers, which I believe Nathan and Simon will be discussing tomorrow. We could also consider global networks of atomic clocks, which Andrei talked about on Monday. And all of these systems offer us a very high sensitivity for defect detection. But considering that defects are likely to be very exotic objects, we could expand our search range by looking at astrophysical systems and looking for non-gravitational signatures as well. So consider, for instance, a defect made up of a scalar field phi interacting with the photon field via a Picard-type coupling. So this will give the photon some kind of non-zero mass inside your defect. And as a result, the defect would act as some kind of cosmic dielectric material with some rather characteristic index of refraction. And this would lend background radiation coming from some star, quasar, or any other luminous source. And this would be quite distinct from lensing by an optical lens, for which generally the index of refraction increases with the frequency of the incident radiation. And it will also be different from gravitational lensing of background radiation by a gravitating body, because gravitational lensing is essentially a frequency-independent effect because it's determined by the curvature of space-time by a gravitating body. On top of this, we could also look for time delay of a periodic background light or radio source, such as a pulsar. And I would like to say a little bit more.
This big lambda there, is it the free parameter? Or?
Which one? Lambda gamma. So it's generally constrained from astrophysical constraints to be of the order of at least 10 tera-electron volts.
Yeah. Right. So theoretically, it's a free parameter.
Increases some mass parameter, right? Because A has dimension 1, and this.
Which one?
This probably m squared there as well. Right?
This one.
No, the other one.
No. So the phi.
Oh, phi.
I've took it into phi.
Okay, so phi is...
Phi has dimensions dimensioned with units of energy. It's a rather strange...
You mean that if phi has units of energy, and lambda has units of energy, phi over lambda is...
Oh, sorry. Energy squared, yes. Energy squared. So pulse is essentially just highly magnetized rotating neutron stars. Yes.
Isn't there a cosmological bound? Is phi cannot be dark matter because it would contribute to the mass of the photon, right?
Which one, sorry?
This phi field cannot have a background component at all.
Why not?
Be dark matter because it would contribute always coming to the photon mass and there are bounds.
Or it
essentially
oscillates to zero by now, right?
Or yes, it depends on what the initial abundance is, right? And how light is filled is. If you're looking for very big defects, that's something to keep in mind.
Yes. But essentially, the idea we had in mind was a phi field in a defect acting as a second Higgs. This was our idea. Mm-hmm. So we have a pulsar. So it's emitting electromagnetic radiation along its magnetic axis, which processes about its rotational axis. And if the Earth is found on the line of sight of one of these magnetic beams, then we will observe pulsar signals in regular time intervals on Earth. And as far as timekeeping purposes are concerned, pulsars have extremely high long-term stability in terms of their period, which is second only to Earth-based atomic clocks. But the stabilities in terms of pulsars as timekeeping devices has actually not improved at all, actually, in the last 20 years. So this value is likely to be stuck to where it is for, well, the conceivable future. So pulsars, we expect them to be very well-behaved objects in that they continually emit electromagnetic radiation. And so as a result of this loss of energy, they're going to be slowing down over time. So the slowdown due to this electromagnetic spin down is essentially linear with time. Then we see something rather odd. Occasionally, so this is an example taken from the Vela pulsar, have a rapid increase in the frequency of rotation of a pulsar, followed by some quasi-exponential recovery to, in general, a state which differs from where your pulsar would have resulted, would have ended up in without one of these glitches occurring. And we parameterize the degree of recovery by this Helium parameter Q. So in general, we can actually have Q values which are quite small and quite close to zero. So there's a number of varieties of different pulsar glitches. And in general, they're still, well, in general, poorly understood phenomenon. And although there is a conventional theory, which if I have time, I'll come back to. So we ask the question is, can parser glitches, for instance, be induced by defects passing through them? And if so, what can we learn about the interactions of defects with standard model particles? So we took the simplest possible approach. We treated a pulsar as a non-relativistic jet of neutron gas. And so the condition of hydrostatic equilibrium requires that this outward degeneracy pressure of the gas exactly compensate the inward gravitational pressure of the pulsar in order to prevent further gravitational collapse. So we have the we can calculate the equilibrium radius of the pulsar in terms of the mass of the pulsar and the constituent neutron mass inside the pulsar. And from this follow the fractional variations in the radius of the pulsar, which can be expressed in terms of fractional variations in the neutron mass.
Can I ask you?
These ones, in general, depends on the pulsar. The most frequent ones are a little at longer time periods than 1 year. So as in 1 year apart.
Ah,
okay. Sometimes
so
in some systems.
For millisecond pulsars or like?
Yes, in general for faster spinning pulsars.
Okay.
If any of that is related to dark matter, then there should be correlation with the glitches happening more often towards the pulsars that are found towards the center.
Yes.
Of the galaxy.
Yeah,
by the
way. That's true. That's
Well,
dark matter
is not
concentrated.
It's concentrated more at the center.
Yeah, but not so strong.
Oh yeah. Some people think that it's dramatically stronger concentrated in the center.
Is it? I thought it's kind of.
Well, it has a large, halo as well, but it's the build up towards the center is less. Or so we think.
Okay, so suppose we have a defect made out of a scalar field interacting with the fermion fields, which is a coupling which is planned to be solved by an atomic clock experiment. So this would result in the renormalization of the standard model fermions. So, well, proton is a composite and fermion, of course, but in terms of the fermions. And so consider a situation in which the pulsar mass was to increase due to an increase in the neutron mass inside a defect, then by this equation, the radius, and because of the prefactor, we'd see that, in fact, the radius and the inertia of this pulsar would decrease, and this could give rise to an increase in the rotational frequency of the pulsar. Yes?
This is maybe a stupid question, but when one of these defects comes through and changes all the laws of physics, why does it have to conserve angular momentum?
Angular momentum. In what way?
Why it speeds up?
Because angular momentum is just... So defects, we presume, are very light objects traveling at non-relativistic speeds. So the angular momentum carried by defects will generally be quite small. So any possible changes in the angular momentum would be quite small.
Okay.
So angular momentum is approximately conserved.
Okay. We're going to assume that the defect doesn't introduce some really weird asymmetry.
Yes. Well, because it interacts by a central interaction, which in principle would conserve angular momentum, but you might have effects, for instance, of tidal friction between your pulsar, which is rotating very rapidly, and your defect as well. But this would be a very small effect. So we expect this to be more or less centrally conserved. So the basic picture which we look at is we consider a defect passing through a pulsar. We'd have a temporary change in the radius of the pulsar. So because of the rapidness of this process, we'd have some sort of pulsar quake being induced.
What is the duration of the collision?
Duration of collision would have to be smaller than 30 seconds based on existing resolution measurements of the increase in this glitch. So we know from spectroscopy that this increase occurs on a time scale of less than 30 seconds. So the passage time would have to be smaller than this.
And what is the typical radius of the
of a pulsar, radius is typically 10 to 15 kilometers.
So you don't know, I mean, this is not the radius from the emission it's coming from, right? This is coming supposedly from somewhere in the magnetosphere, which could be significantly farther away.
Which one, sorry?
I mean, we're actually looking at electromagnetic emission from this pulsar.
Yes, so electromagnetic emission is responsible for this part of the graph. And this is the poorly understood part, the comparatively poorly understood part. It's a rather strange process because it's believed that you go to some sort of non-equilibrium state here. And because we don't actually know, well, with any certainty, the exact internal structure of a pulsar, then we can't actually predict, well, with any certainty, what this actual non-equilibrium state is going to be. So, well, I've actually said it here. So after this, the pulsar will be left in some long-lived outer equilibrium state. And then this would undergo slow relaxation toward, in general, some state.
Wouldn't yes. you expect it to oscillate if it's in non-equilibrium state? It's kind of contracted.
Depends on the viscosity coefficient.
Yeah.
If it's an overdamped regime, then you just have exponential decay in principle.
Yeah.
So it depends on the exact model which you would use.
But yeah, you need some kind of mechanism.
I know, but it looks as though there's actually no good one already in literature.
So you don't see oscillations.
So you don't see oscillations, no. That's why this is particularly strange.
But the time scale for this exponent?
Time scale is roughly from a day to years. And it varies even inside the same pulsar and between different pulsars.
Oh, so is there a pulsar who have more than one glitch?
Vela and Crab pulses are very regular. Vela has had, in the last 40 years, roughly 25 glitches. It's quite a lot. And some pulses in that period have maybe had only one. So it varies a lot from pulsar to pulsar.
Right, so then...
It's not predictable
for this,
when they occur.
Is there any periodicity with that 25 glitches?
Periodicity?
Is it a bound system?
It's yeah, like a defect passing through like that. It depends. It's not exactly periodic. So this is why it's rather strange. And some glitches, you get to a recovery. So you might be recovering, and you might have another unexpected glitch without incomplete recovery having occurred. So they're very, very strange phenomena.
Most of them are inside of our galaxy, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So if we consider, well, as an order of magnitude estimate, the increase in the rotational frequency, the maximum increase, would be of the order of the fractional change in the neutron mass caused by this defect. And so if we consider, well, the ranges on the existing pulsar glitches, we see that the neutron mass variations may be expected to lie in this range.
Changes during the
yes.
Passage, and
then it goes back to the original.
But the frequency jumps. And
the frequency jumps, yes.
And why does it go back?
Because you've reached some non-equilibrium state.
Okay.
In general, my first impression. Yes, it's a very complicated. I expected to see this.
Right.
Yes.
But then the mass returned. Immediately back.
Almost immediately, yes.
Start immediately.
It's in principle. But it's a change in internal structure, most likely. And nuclear theoreticians can't agree on what exactly happens. And so, well,
some
last
kind
slide.
Phase transition to quark matter.
Quark gluon plasma in the center. I've heard that, but maybe not. So, just last slide. What are the implications for atomic Earth detection schemes? So, consider. The passage of a defect, as Andre talked about earlier, well, for a GPS network, this might be 150 seconds. For the Earth, roughly 40 seconds. So we want, for hyperfine transitions, hyperfine clocks, sensitivities of the order of 10 to negative 11 at least, to look for these transient variations of the frequencies on the order of timescales of 1 second to 1 minute, or possibly a few more minutes. And this is good, well, if this is true, because this is already achievable with existing hydrogen mesa, cesium, and rubidium hyperfine clocks. And as an added bonus, GPS satellites already carry onboard cesium rubidium clocks, as Andre pointed out. And so we can increase the range of Earth-based experiments for the detection of these defects. And finally, I'd like to mention that, well, if it is in fact a variation of neutron mass, then the mass of the Earth would be altered and we'd have an altered period of rotation. And finally, just to in keeping with the spirit of this conference, we could have transient electric dipole moments induced by the similar couplings from before, and we can have like a GNOME EDM project of sorts. So we could have three global network schemes possibly. Thank you.